All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 662 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, we'll be continuing the genetic sprint. If you missed 661, that's part one of the series. I'll strongly encourage you to go back and listen to it. Let's begin. So what if they give you a question about a 19-year-old, and you're told that this 19-year-old male comes to the emergency room because he has a very severe headache? You're told that he's had many episodes like this over the last, 6 months, has very severe headaches, has like blurry vision, and you're told that he's actually being evaluated right now by an ophthalmologist for a lesion that was found on a fundoscopic exam. And you're told that, that his blood pressure is on presentation is a 190 over 110. So systolic 190, diastolic 110. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? Well, I'd really hope that you're thinking that this person probably has a feel, and this person probably has like some kind of optic nerve tumor. If you put these two things together, it should make you think of what? I'd hope you're saying Divine, NF1, neurofibromatosis type 1. Right. So again, what are the key things to know here as we walk through this sprint? Well, remember, NF1 is an autosomal dominant disorder, right? It's an autosomal dominant disorder, right? You certainly want to make sure you know that, right? It's an autosomal dominant disorder, and the mutation is in neurofibromin, right? Neurofibromin is it's pretty much like a thing that suppresses RAS signaling. I think some of you may not realize this, but the USMLEs these days, they like to put answer choices that are a little bit removed from what you know. It's just kind of like a nice protection against people that don't understand pathophysiology or don't, just blindly memorize stuff. So just remember that it's basically a mutation in a tumor suppressor gene, right? Something that normally suppresses RAS signaling. But if you have this mutation, then you won't be able to suppress RAS signaling, and you're going to have a lot of tumors forming, right? You're going to have a lot of tumors forming. That's the job of neurofibromin. So again, NF1, it's a problem in chromosome 17 with a neurofibromin gene, right? Now, what are the classic findings in this disease? Well, you're going to see things like Café au lait spots. Remember, those tend to be hyperpigmented. And then they're going to have these neurofibromas. That's why it's called neurofibromatosis, right? They're going to have some eye problems. They're going to have like Leish nodules of the iris, right? Those are iris or hematomas. They can have optic nerve gliomas, right? So that can cause an afferent pupillary defect on your exams, right? Remember, they can have like axillary and inguinal freckling, right? So the crevices of their bodies, they can have freckles, right? And again, remember chromosome 17. That's the key thing to remember with the chromosome where it's inherited from. Now, one thing I'm just going to say is, why was the person's blood pressure high? Well, it was high because they had a fear. Right. Remember, for purposes of the USMLE exams, they really do want you to know the disorders that have an association with pheochromocytomas. Right. Now, what are those disorders? Don't forget MEN2. The MEN2s have an association with a pheochromocytoma. NF1 has an association with pheochromocytoma. And VHL, von Hippel-Lindau. You may notice that all these things are autosomal dominant disorders. They all have associations with pheochromocytomas. So I'll certainly know that for exams if I were you. Now, one other thing I just want to kind of throw out here is, people that have NF1, is there a particular screening guideline you think makes sense for these people? Well, I'd hope you're saying that, wait, Divine, they should probably be getting annual eye exams, which makes sense. Why? Because again, these people, they have a lot of eye problems, right? They have a lot of eye problems. So it makes sense that they should be getting a lot of eye exams, right? Now, you want to be able to compare and contrast NF1 with NF2, right? So remember, NF2 is a chromosome 22 defect, unlike NF1, that's a chromosome 17 defect, right? Now, the thing you need to know about NF2 is that the mutation is in a gene known as Merlin, right? It's a Merlin gene mutation. It's also autosomal dominant, right? And again, the mutation is in a tumor suppressor gene. Right? So the thing is, NF2, it encodes something called a Merlin, right? Sometimes on exams, you may see them refer to it as schwannomin, S-C-H-W-A-N-N-O-M-I-N, S-C-H-W-A-N-O-M-I-N, schwannomin, right? It's a tumor suppressor gene, you know, from almost like from a cytoskeletal perspective, right? From a cytoskeletal perspective. But I think the big thing to just know here is many times these people on the exams, they'll have these bilateral vestibular schwannomas. They can say that, ooh, you see bilateral masses at the cerebellopontine angle. So the junction of like the cerebellum and the pons, that's a very common location of vestibular schwannomas. Sometimes they call those acoustic neuromas, right? They can talk about the person having like progressive bilateral hearing loss, tinnitus, and things like that, right? Or you may see them having tumors that are in the cerebral convexities, right? So like meningiomas. Or you may see them having hydrocephalus, right? Or increased ICPs. And then they show you a brain image that shows a fourth ventricular mass. That's an ependymoma, right? Remember, these people tend to have schwannomas, meningiomas, and ependymomas. In fact, some people call this MESME in the land of radiology, MSME, right? MESME, right? So the MS stands for multiple schwannomas, the M stands for meningiomas, and then the E stands for ependymomas, right? So they have multiple schwannomas, meningiomas, and ependymomas, right? So again, make sure you can differentiate this from NF1, right? But again, remember, please, guys, the USMLEs, they love surrogates these days. They can literally give you these disorders, and the right answer will be tumor suppressor gene mutation, or like, for example, NF1, we talked about how it's they can tell you something about extensive RAS signaling or whatever, right? So you're just going to keep that at the back of your mind as you prep for your exams, right? And then what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that this child, you know, is brought to the physician for an eye exam, right? And that mass is found in the right eye, right? And then they give you some labs and you notice that the child has a very high hematocrit, right? Has a high hematocrit. And then they tell you that, you know, brain imaging shows a mass, you know, not just in the eye. So they try to further characterize the mass. They find the mass not just in the eye, but they also find the mass in the posterior fossa of the head. If you see something like that, what should you be thinking about? Well, I'd hope you're thinking that, wait, this person probably has like VHL. Right, this person has VHL, von Hippel-Lindau. Right, von Hippel-Lindau disease is very, very high yield to know for your exams. It is what? Very, very high yield to know for your exams. Right, again, this is a chromosome 3 problem. Right, and I'm going to explain the eye and the brain, whatever. This is a chromosome 3 problem. It's autosomal dominant inheritance, again, in a tumor suppressor gene. Are you noticing something here? I almost want to call this the tumor suppressor gene podcast, but it's pretty high yield to know this, right? Many of these mutations are in tumor suppressor genes. When you have these tumor suppressor gene mutations, you're going to have crazy, 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 crazy proliferation of tumors, right? So the thing is, if you have this mutation in VHL, right, then you're going to stop degrading HIF-1 alpha, HIF-1 alpha, HIF-1 alpha, HIF-1 alpha. And the thing is, when you stop degrading HIF-1 alpha, HIF-1 alpha is a signal. It pretty much tells your body that, oh, there's hypoxia here. Oh no, there's hypoxia here, right? And if your body thinks there is hypoxia there, then you're going to make a lot of angiogenic factors. A lot of angiogenic factors. Angiogenic factors. And when you make all these angiogenic factors, you're going to make a lot of angiogenic tumors. Like what? Like hemangioblastomas. Like hemangioblastomas. So these people, they tend to have hemangioblastomas of the cerebellum, right? Remember, typically this is going to be a mass in the posterior fossa, typically in the cerebellum, right? And it's going to contain calcifications, right? So if you see a mass that is calcified in the posterior fossa on the USMLE exams, think about a hemangioblastoma in a child. If you see a mass that is calcified and it's a supratentorial mass, and they tell you that, oh wait, this mass is in the, you know, it's a suprasellar mass, then you want to be thinking about a craniopharyngioma under those circumstances. But basically, these people have a lot of hemangioblastomas, and you can have hemangioblastomas in the cerebellum, so the posterior fossa. You can have hemangioblastomas in the retina. You can have hemangioblastomas in the spine, right? And the thing is, these hemangioblastomas, they love to make EPO in a paraneoplastic fashion, right? They love to make EPO in a paraneoplastic fashion. That EPO can cause polycythemia, right? So that's something pretty high yield you want to know for your exams, right? And remember, what are some other things you may find in a person that has VHL? Well, these people can have bilateral clear cell renal cell carcinoma. Sometimes they can have pheochromocytomas. Remember, I said that it's one of those genetic diseases that has an association with a fear. Again, what are the diseases that have an association with a fear? Don't forget your MEN2s. Don't forget VHL. And don't forget NF1. Don't forget those three. Very important to know those for your test. All right. And then they can also have like, so they give you a question about a young patient that has a polycythemia or has like multiple renal cell carcinomas. They have a cerebellar mass. Think of VHL. Think of VHL, right? Don't be thinking of renal cell carcinoma as being spontaneous in a person that is like 15 years old that's diagnosed with it. That's ridiculous, right? That's ridiculous. No, it should be in a person that is quite a bit older, right? Remember, the biggest risk factor for RCC is smoking, right? But you see like multiple renal cell carcinomas in a very young person, that person has a genetic disease, right? That person has von Hippel-Lindau. Or if you notice many family members, that's another way they can present it to you on your exams. You see a person where many family members have renal cell carcinomas, think of that family having von Hippel-Lindau disease, because again, it's autosomal dominant, right? So obviously it's going to run in families. It's not necessarily going to skip generations or anything like that. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a child and you're told that this child, is brought to the neurologist because he has been having multiple seizures, right? He has been having multiple seizures, right? And you're told that he's in a special needs program, at school, right? And then you're told that physical examination discloses hypopigmented skin lesions. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? Well, I'd really hope you're saying, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like tuberous sclerosis, right? Tuberous sclerosis. Again, what's the skinny on this disease? It's autosomal dominant, and it's in what kind of gene? In a tumor suppressor gene, right? You can have a TSC1 or a TSC2 mutation. So what do these things normally do? Well, the thing is, these things normally, they inhibit mTOR. They inhibit what? mTOR. M-T-O-R. They inhibit mTOR, right? So when you have mutations in these things, mTOR is no longer inhibited. So you're going to have uncontrolled growth of cells. You're going to have formation of hematomas, right? And the thing is, and this is in many different organs, you can form hematomas in many different organs, So if you see these hematomas in the brain, that's what usually causes the seizures and the intellectual disability that they get, right? Like tubers in the brain. That's why it's called tuberous sclerosis, right? So what are the skin lesions I was talking about? Well, those are the ash leaf spots. Those are the hypopigmented macules, right? They can have these things known as chagrin patches. They can have these facial angiofibromas. So like vascular-like tumors on the face, right? Now, in terms of the heart, remember, they can have cardiac rhabdomyomas, right? Cardiac rhabdomyomas. It's actually like a tumor you can find in the heart, right? They will try to trick you on your exams with cardiac myxoma. Myxomas are not found on the USMLEs in tuberous sclerosis. It's cardiac rhabdomyomas that are found in tuberous sclerosis, right? And then if they tell you that they have like flank pain or like back pain or they have hematuria, then you want to think about the renal angiomyolipomas. Angiomyolipomas, right? It's a renal tumor that contains blood vessels, contains muscle, and contains fat, right? Angiomyolipomas, right? Those are the classic associated tumors, right? So again, keep that at the back of your mind for your exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a person, like a lady, or they tell you that, oh, in this family, they've noticed that they have a lot of early onset breast cancer, early onset leukemia, right? Early onset, like soft tissue tumors, like all these sarcomas. If you see something like this, I want you to think of a person having a P53 mutation, right? Think of a person that has a P53 mutation. So what are the four classic associated cancers with a P53 mutation? Because I don't know, for whatever reason, resources don't just talk about this very much, but it's actually pretty high to know for exams, right? Think of breast cancer, think of leukemia, think of adrenocortical cancers, right? So cancers of the adrenal gland, and then soft tissue sarcomas, right? So breast cancer, leukemias, sarcomas, right? And the adrenal corticular tumors, right? The way I remember this is the mnemonic labs, getting labs on a patient. So the L stands for leukemia, the A stands for adrenal cortical carcinomas, the B stands for breast cancer, the S stands for sarcomas. Right? You see those tumors running in families, showing up really early in life. Think of a P53 mutation, right? Again, autosomal dominant, right? In a tumor suppressor gene. Now, what's the disease I'm referring to here? I'd hope you're saying, oh, divine, okay, this has to be Lee Fromenai, which it exactly is. This is Lee Fromenai syndrome. Lee Fromenai syndrome, right? Lee Fromenai syndrome, it's a P53 mutation, right? And many people know P53 as the guardian of the genome, right? The guardian of the genome. The thing is, whenever you have a P53 mutation, right, you're going to have abnormal cell cycle arrest, right? You're going to have... You're going to not be having apoptosis after DNA damage. Because remember, whenever you're doing the cell cycle and your body notices that, oh, shoot, it seems like there is DNA damage or whatever, you're not going to progress in the cell cycle. You're going to arrest the cell cycle. That cell is going to undergo apoptosis. But if you have a P53 mutation, your body is going to be like, eh, we have this DNA mutation. Who cares? It's not a big deal. Let's keep going, right? The cell cycle will progress when it should not. The cell will keep living when it should not. You won't have apoptosis, right? And that's going to cause problems. Again, remember the labs mnemonic for the tumors that they get, right? So if you notice a person developing many of these cancers that I'm talking about, usually before like ages 30 to 40, think of Lee Fromenai syndrome. Think of Lee Fromenai syndrome, right? Think of Lee Fromenai syndrome, all right? And again, remember, you need... Two mutations to have this problem, right? You need two mutations to have this problem. Let me just kind of develop that point a little bit because it's something that is actually pretty high yield to know for your exams. So the thing is, when you, you know, it kind of follows the same thing as like retinoblastoma, right? So the thing is, these tumor suppressor genes, right? Obviously, we're diploid organisms, right? So we have two copies of these genes. The thing is, if you have a mutation in one copy, it's not a big deal. You're not going to have problems, right? Because you still have one normal copy. That one normal copy is producing enough tumor suppressor protein, so you're not in trouble. You're fine. But, so you're heterozygous for the mutation to start, right? You're heterozygous. But when the second... Because the gene is expressed in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? So if you have one good one around, it's not a big deal. But once the second one is mutated and then you become homozygous for the mutation, then you have no tumor suppressor gene products, then you're going to get in trouble. That genetic phenomenon, they love to test it on the USMLE exams. It's called a loss of heterozygosity. A loss of heterozygosity. When you lose heterozygosity, then you start getting in trouble. You start getting in trouble. All right. So pretty high yield to know that for your exams. All right. So don't forget, Lee Fromenai syndrome, P53 mutation. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, she's age 30, she's diagnosed with like ovarian cancer. Right, diagnosed with ovarian cancer, right? And they tell you that her mom died of breast cancer, of invasive breast cancer at age 35. When you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I hope you're thinking about BRCA mutations, right? BRCA mutations, right? You know, BRCA1, BRCA2. And let me say something here. Again, autosomal dominant tumor suppressor genes. But there are some kind of funny things our friends at the MBMEs love to do with these people. That is actually pretty high yield to know. So the thing is, they know that many of you can recognize the term BRCA pretty easily, right? Many of you can recognize the term BRCA pretty easily. So do you know sometimes what they do on the USMLE exams? One thing they do sometimes these days is that they will call it hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome. Hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome. If you see that term, that's just a fancy term for BRCA on your exams. Just keep that in mind. Now remember, we can have mutations in BRCA1 or in BRCA2. BRCA1 is a mutation in chromosome 17. BRCA2 is a mutation in chromosome 13. So 1 for 17, 2 for 13. Is there another disease we've talked about where the mutation is in chromosome 17? NF1. Very good. NF1, right? So BRCA1 is a chromosome 17 mutation. BRCA2 is a chromosome 13 mutation. Again, these are both autosomal dominant disorders, right, in tumor suppressor genes, right? And what do these things do? Again, remember, for each of these things in this genetic sprint, I'm trying to give you some context on the genetic mechanism, right? Where necessary. There are some of these diseases where the genetic mechanism, no one, you know, you shouldn't care about those. They almost never test those, but there are many that they do test, right? Again, they know that many of you have, in your Anki Dex, have memorized the chromosome or whatever. What they know many of you don't understand or know is the pathway that leads to a tumor, right? So make sure you know these things. Make sure you know these things, right? So these people, they have BRCA1, BRCA2 mutations, right? And those things are involved in double-stranded DNA break repair. Double-stranded DNA break repair. So think about it. If you mess up double-stranded DNA break repair, you're going to have lots of problems with tumors. And is there another genetic disease you may want to know for your exams that's associated with issues with double-stranded DNA break repair? I'd hope you're saying, oh, Divine, ataxia telangiectasia. Ataxia telangiectasia is also an issue with a double-stranded DNA break repair, right? So what are some other kind of high-yield things to know here? Well, remember BRCA1, it carries a high risk of ovarian cancer, right? It has a higher ovarian cancer risk compared to BRCA2. Sometimes they test some of these strange epidemiologic facts with these BRCA mutations, right? So don't get me wrong, BRCA1, BRCA2 can both cause ovarian cancer, but the one that carries the higher ovarian cancer risk is BRCA1. BRCA2 has an association with not just breast and ovarian cancer, but it's also associated with like pancreatic cancer, right? In fact, when people are diagnosed with BRCA mutations, they do need to be screened for pancreatic cancer, right? And also male breast cancer. You see a man that has breast cancer, that man has to be screened for a BRCA2 mutation, All right. And one thing that you should know is that these people start getting screened for breast cancer at age 25. Starting at age 25, they're going to get annual breast MRIs, right? Annual breast MRIs. And then once they get to age 30, they're going to get annual breast MRIs and mammograms. Annual breast MRIs and mammograms, right? We don't start the mammograms until they hit age 30. Right. So again, if you see a strong family history of early onset breast cancer, early onset ovarian cancer across many generations, think of, again, hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome. Super, super high yield to know for your exams. Now, one thing I'm just going to say that you should know here for these people in terms of treatment, there are these groups of drugs known as the PARP, P-A-R-P, inhibitors that are helpful for these people. It kind of exploits the pathway that is messed up in people that have BRCA mutations. That's about as far as I'm going to go here in terms of PARP inhibitors. I'll probably talk about it in more detail in a future podcast. And then the last disorder I will talk about on the exams is, so what if they give you a question about a child and you're told that this child, has been complaining of a very significant bone pain, right? Let's say it's a 13-year-old child complaining of very significant bone pain in the right lower extremity, right? In the right lower extremity. And then you're told that this child has a severe short bowel syndrome, you know, because of extensive resection of the person has had a procedure where bowel was extensively resected a few years ago. If you see something like this, think of FAP, right? Familial adenomatous polyposis, right? Remember, this is an APC mutation, chromosome 5, autosomal dominant disorder, right? And again, this is in a tumor suppressor gene. Right. So what does EPC normally do? Let's do the cell biology integration here. Normally, it degrades something known as beta catenin. I'm pretty sure I did research on stuff like this, like back in the day in college or something crazy, I think. Right. But it degrades beta catenin. Right. Now, the thing is, when you are not able to degrade beta catenin, so C-A-T-E-N-I-N anymore, then you're going to have crazy, crazy Wnt signaling, WNT signaling. Right. And the thing that's going to happen as a result of that is that your colonic epithelial cells, they're going to proliferate like crazy. Right. So these people are going to have like thousands of colonic adenomatous polyps, and those things can become cancerous, especially when you throw in a KRAS mutation on top or a P53 mutation on top, then that can get you in trouble. Right. So for these people, colon cancer is pretty much inevitable. Right. If you don't do a colectomy, that's why this person in this question has a short bowel syndrome. Right. So remember, why do they have this right lower extremity pain? It's because they have Gardner syndrome. Remember, Gardner syndrome is when you have FAP. Right. And you have like osteomas. You have like these soft tissue tumors like osteomas, desmoid tumors, epidermoid cysts and things like that. If you see a person that has FAP and they have brain tumors, think of Turcot syndrome, T-U-R-C-O-C-O-T, right? And remember, these people, generally, they need colonoscopies starting at age 10, right? Starting at age 10, they need colonoscopies just because of all these problems that they can have with colorectal cancer, right? And remember, these people, prophylactic colectomy is recommended once you confirm that they have this disease, because again, it's not a matter of if, they're going to develop colorectal cancer at some point in their lives. All right, so I think this has kind of gone on for long. So again, there's going to be another part. It is actually a pretty high yield series, but just a lot of things I want to talk about, but these are easy points on the exams if you know these things. And if you love the way I teach, you love the way I make integrations, you're going to love my classes. I'm going to have a bunch of classes that start not next week, but the week after next. I have a CCS KCS class. It's a 1 hour class. I have a test taking strategies class that's 2.5 hours long, biostats class that's 4 hours long, and a social sciences quality improvement, healthcare systems, and an ethics class that's a 5 hour class. These four classes, the first one, the CCS class, obviously is for step three, but the other three are for step 1, 2, 3. And then beyond that, I have a last minute review for step 2 and step 3. That's 3 hours long. And then I have a 20-hour step 2, step 3 class. Many people have taken these classes and done extremely well on the exams. I've literally gotten an email, I believe, from somebody within the last 2 or 3 weeks that took one of my classes and got like almost got in the high 270s, right? So my classes are very well validated. They're very well put together classes, right? They prepare people really well for the USMLE exams. So if you're interested, shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE and Comlex exams, and I help with ERAS applications as well. So if you're interested in any of these things, shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. And I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel you can check out as well. And then I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower, so every week I post like one podcast where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 663. Have a wonderful day. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.